This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 11th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 175, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Artemis Cooper to discuss one of the 20th century's most charismatic writers and, some say, the inspiration behind James Bond, Patrick Leigh Fermor.
And Obama's back in, but was it a fair contest? We'll speak to US journalist and comic Mo Rocca to find out how the US voting system can affect the result.
And we'll also be hearing the latest hopes for Syria's future with journalist Lara Satrakian and looking at London's storied past with the author Pete Brown.
All that's come, plus a look ahead to next week's news agenda and some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. It's us. We're on. There's a green light. We're here.
And we've got a big, big show ahead.
We've got a big show.
Mr. Robert Bound. We're going to be going around the world, I think. All around the world.
We're going to spin the globe and stick some pins in it.
And I think we're going to start in a minute with kind of tromping across. Can you tromp? It's better than tromping.
I don't know. Stomp.
You stomp, don't you?
Or tramp.
Yeah,
you can't stromp. Or you can't. Yeah.
You can, but it's not very nice in public.
No.
But anyway, we're going to be heading across Europe first of all, and I think we're going to be ending up down the pub.
So
we've got a bit of a journey to make.
How all good journeys end.
Now you've been in Russia.
I've been in Russia, yeah, which was quite amazing. In Siberia, in Krasnoyarsk, in southern Siberia, near the Mongolian border. I say near the Mongolian border. It's the nearest Russian city to Mongolia, I think. But that doesn't say much. There's still a few thousands of miles of mountain ranges in the way.
You weren't being punished by our editor-in-chief. You didn't say, you're off to Siberia, mate.
It wasn't social Siberia. It wasn't quite a gulag either. Okay. But it was amazing. It was for our Alpino, our upcoming thing. I took my Marantz, my radio recorder, and did a bit of radio stuff there as well. But half of it was for a literary festival, and some of the rest of it was simply to look around and get slightly lost in this strange city and then in the hills surrounding it in Siberia.
I have literally no idea what it physically looks like, that city. Is it a Soviet relic? Or
it is a sort of, it's a Soviet, unfortunately it's more of a Soviet relic than a Tsarist relic. So it used to be this beautiful wood-timbered town, really. And there are some of those buildings still standing. There are some amazing Orthodox churches that are still standing, painted in these beautiful, gaudy, St. Basil-esque colours. But there's a lot of square, kind of Khrushchev-era kind of boxes, unfortunately. But it sort of adds to that romance, that sort of Soviet hangover romance that perhaps we still have about Russia or certain parts of Russia.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So no, I had a great time. I was with a friend of mine, Alex Preston, who's a sometime contributor to the magazine as well, whose novel is in the top 10 in translation in Russia. So we had a bit of a night out at the hands of the British Council while we were in Moscow as well, which we won't talk about on the radio.
Okay, let's save all that for
Alpino. Save that. Yeah.
That's our winter newspaper that's just going into production now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So we've got some nice snowy pictures from Siberia to stick in there.
Moon boots on, kids.
I don't know how we go from that to the news roundup with Tom Edwards, but maybe a little sound effect will help us get there. And you're tuned into the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck. And we've been joined now. A sort of puff of smoke by Tom Edwards. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Rob. How are you today?
All right. What's wrong with you? You're a bit
looking
weird.
Nervous.
Do you not like sharing studio time with me?
No, I do. It's one of this is probably the highlight. It's the highlight of my week. I was quite sad last week. I wasn't able to fulfil this obligation.
This mystic ability to look into the future of the world of news.
Exactly. Glad to be back.
Where are you going to start with?
Well, I thought I'd start with something that's happening tomorrow. Mark Thompson is taking over as the CEO at the New York Times. This is the former BBC Director General who's stood down in September, sort of resuming his career at the New York Times. A real difficult task on a business level. You know, we talk a lot on Monocle 24 about media models, how to engage with digital whilst staying true to your, you know, traditional brand values, this kind of thing. A difficult ask for him, made even more complicated by the fact that he arrives with something of a shadow of a scandal from the BBC kind of hanging over him. A lot of speculation already on the other side of the pond that it's going to be very difficult for him to really take the initiative in this job and get stuck into it, while there'll still be some questions about what he knew about this this scandal that's bedeviling the BBC.
And is there much of an idea of him as a public persona? I mean, he wasn't much of a public persona. Clearly, as Director General of the BBC, you'd have to be like in the media world to really know who he was in the UK. Is there a sense that possibly the competitors, maybe the Murdoch Press, maybe the New York Post and things, are slightly gunning for him as he starts his job?
I think that's a real problem for him, because one of the things the Director General at the BBC has to do is be exactly what you say. They're a figurehead, but they're usually quite faceless. I think most of the public don't recognise them. As you say, it's a very big figure within media. In America, CEOs are expected to be more visible. They're expected to be more ambassadorial for their brands, to be more outspoken, to be more aggressive in their pursuit of their business objectives. And so I think this is going to be difficult for him, especially when he's going to be confronted at every turn by, as you say, a frankly rather hostile press environment.
Mm. Although what's interesting, I guess, is that the New York Times, it has something about it of being beyond commercial, doesn't it? It seems to be, you know, it thinks of itself as, you know, obviously as a newspaper of record, and kind of standing slightly above some of the kind of melee that's going on in the rest of the US media. So maybe there is a kind of little kind of link there with the world of the BBC. A little aside for you, I was telling a friend about talking about Monocle, and he was quizzing me about our media model. And another friend of mine, Paul Cameron, was listening in, but only half listening in. And he said, your media model, is that the guy with the beard? No. Bad luck. And he's in business. Who knew? Next story. Nice.
Well, I thought this one would be maybe one more for Rob. You ever want to get your hands on a screaming pope?
you had your hand on one the other night,
yes,
didn't you?
Exactly. I think you might be referring to Francis Bacon.
I am indeed. Now, this is Untitled, brackets Pope, which is, you know, one of his most famous works. Yeah. It's from the Screaming Pope series. It will go under the hammer on Tuesday. It was bought for about £70,000.
This is a New York auction.
Back
it?
In the 70s. Yeah. And it's been part of a private collection, obviously, for what now, almost 40 years. It's thought it might go for around 15 million.
Yeah, it's a massive one. These were the studies of, I can't remember the Pope, which Pope it was. Maybe, I think it was Pius IX. And these were the studies that he did off Velázquez's famous paintings.
That's which, right. That was Pope Innocent X.
Innocent X.
Velázquez's ones.
Yeah. And we saw in the Prado, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
And in Madrid. And so these are sort of even more famous than the Velázquez's as pieces of modern art.
Well, it's interesting. I think Bacon is someone who, within the contemporary art market, still now, he is regarded as one of the figures you must have. And in this slightly unpleasant, acquisitive nature of some of the modern collectors, it's a badge of honour, and he's actually really, really highly sought after, beyond even some of the more established masters even than him. And his works are relatively scarce, obviously.
That's the good thing about, the good thing about Bacon is they're all great, and there's not many of them. Mm. So you don't have that kind of, there was no Bacon factory.
No, they weren't, like, he wasn't sort of one of the...
There was a pork scratching factory, but no Bacon factory.
No, he wasn't one of the kind of commodifiers of art. And these works are really, I find them, I wouldn't want one. Even if I had 15 million.
It's a very terrifying painting.
They're so dark. They're so full of menace. They're such kind of heavy. I can't. I mean, I guess maybe the people who would acquire them.
You're not going to buy it, is what you're saying.
Oh, you know, I'll go along. I'll run my eye over it.
Is it going to be a telephone bid from Edwards?
It could be.
So no one knows.
It could just be.
Right. Next story. We've got to have a super speedy next story.
Okay. Well, I was going to do a very depressing story about what's happening on Wednesday.
Thanks.
So this was going to be Spain and Portugal, general strike, mayhem. But I think that's too depressing.
Okay.
So something else that's happening on Wednesday, one of my favourites.
The Champions League.
Now, come on, Rob, let's be serious for a moment. This is still Monocle 24. Right. Elmore Leonard is receiving the medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters 2012. I love Elmore Leonard's works.
He of love his LA Confidential and things like that.
Out of Sight, Get Shorty.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. I think he's superb. A great writer of dialogue, beautiful observer of, you know, Americana, and he's receiving the medal for Distinguished Contribution. Well done him. I'll be applauding on Wednesday.
Well done, Elmore, for the time being. Tom Edwards, thank you very much for joining us. Our first guest is the historian and writer Artemis Cooper. Her latest study looks at the life of Patrick Leigh Fermor, a man whose career across the 20th century included everything from Second World War hero to celebrated travel writer.
Something of a male archetype of a bygone era, it's said that Fermor's charisma helped inspire Ian Fleming's vision for James Bond. To tell us more about him, Artemis Cooper joins us in the studio now. We were just touching on the fact before we came on air that you've had some amazing reviews for this book.
I know, it's wonderful, isn't it?
It is great, but what is the secret of your insight, Tim? You knew the man and you had great access, but even so, many people have that when they start writing a biography and they get lost in it in a way because they know the person. I think all the reviews and certainly reading the book ourselves, there's a kind of knowingness about him, but also a distance. You can step back as well and comment and be amusing about him as well.
Well, that's lovely to hear. I'm not quite sure how it happened. I suppose you get a voice for a book somewhere, hopefully, along the line. But I very much wanted the reader to hear his voice. And I think that's sort of one of the important things. And through his voice, what I'm now calling Paddy Power seems to come through. He used to love those shops, you know. I remember once he passed by a Paddy Power shop and he said, "I hope I'm sending good luck to all those guys in there."
Is that right? He's a great spokesman for the betting industry at the same time. And we talked about the good reviews, Artemis. Is a helpful thing, the fact that it's about the life of Patrick Leigh Fermor? Are readers and the public well disposed to him, you know, and the legend of Paddy?
I think they're hugely well disposed to him. I mean, you've got practically a sort of winning combination. I mean, an enviably well-packed life full of incredible things, whether he's being a war hero or tramping around Greece or, you know, as a sort of pretty well a tramp as an 18-year-old suddenly staying in all these country houses and schlosses. And so there's so much packed into his life, plus the amazing books. So he seems to tick every button, plus this extraordinary gift he has, which I hope shines through the book, which is that he made people feel so great.
And what do you think was his secret of his success in those early days? He made this extraordinary journey where he walked across Europe. That's the beginning of his kind of a fame, I guess, in a way. In a way, he was lucky to do it at a really interesting period in history. This was just as the Nazis were coming to power. Was he a man that was, you know, obviously blessed with amazing gifts, but was he also helped by these accidents of history in a way, kind of chiming with his become such a celebrated travel writer?
I think that's probably true. But at the same time, we all have to live in a time and make the most of it. He, in a funny way, he was living through that particular walk is happening in between the two world wars. Europe had already changed beyond recognition after the peace treaties of 1919. And yet Paddy, although he makes, you know, reference to that in the new boundaries and this, that and the other political tensions, he's also looking back to a Europe that hasn't changed for millennia. So you have these two things at the same time.
I remember extraordinarily reading, you know, his books, and there is this, you know, him going through kind of East, what's now we think of as Eastern Europe, Middle Europa, and him describing a peasantry, a kind of way of life, that it was just about to be. I think that's also what makes the book so moving in a way, is that you know, because of history, what these people don't in the fields don't know. You know that, you know, there will be tanks coming across here in a few years' time. And he's capturing a moment really on the cusp, about to be lost.
That's right. I think that's absolutely true. And at the same time, and this is the extraordinary dislocation between the young man of 18 who's making that journey and the man of middle years, 30-something years later, who's writing the book. So, yes, he can look back. And with him, we know what's going to happen. And as you say, the tanks rolling across that beautiful countryside. At the same time, he's so in touch with the joy of the person he was then.
I wanted to know, Artemis, where you draw the line between a travel writer and a historian. Because I wonder whether it's to do with the amount of yourself that you put in the book, or the amount that Paddy put into his books as well. When you talk about the interactions that you yourself have with the people that you meet, that makes you a travel writer rather than the dispassionate view of a historian. Is that something you juggled as well?
I think that's probably absolutely right. I think you nailed it there. The travel writer is always, you know, he's going through it. He has his senses, he's at the mercy of everybody, especially if you're alone. You're very, you know, you're vulnerable, you're open to people.
Yeah.
The historian looks back usually from the safety of a cold archive and has to put it all together.
You'd rather go for a drink with Paddy as a travel writer than a historian, right?
Yes, but I mean, I don't know whether he would even have considered himself a historian.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, of course he loved history, but he talked about mugging up. We talk about his scholarship. He talks about mugging up.
Yeah.
In other words, reading the books, talking to the scholars.
And I suppose he was more of a classicist than a historian specifically as well.
I think
this
so,
is where
yeah.
His love of Greece came from that very classic mythic
Absolutely,
background.
Yes, yeah. Yes, indeed.
And can you tell us a little bit about his war history and why that was such an extraordinary moment for him?
Yeah, well, I suppose the moment that he's always associated with is the kidnapping of General Kuiper in May 1944. And it is an extraordinary moment, and it was so close to not coming off at all. They kidnapped the general in his car, Paddy and Billy Moss dressed in German uniform, saying, you know, Hände hoch, halt Papier bitte, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then when the doors open, lots of cretins appear out of the woodwork and, you know, they're captured. And then Billy Moss, absolutely brilliant driver, drives through 22 German checkpoints through the centre of Heraklion, where there's German soldiers everywhere. And they manage to make it through. And then, of course, the Germans are after the general trying to find him. And it was touch and go, wireless breakdowns, messages not getting through. It's one disaster after the next, and it really was touch and go that they got him off at all. But of course, having done it, this incredible coup, it's sort of one of the kind of, you know, boys' own stories of the war. Paddy, of course, in the years after the war, when every man is defined by what sort of a war he's had, Paddy's DSO shines with a terrific lustre. Although I think by the end of his life, the Kuiper operation had become something of an albatross around his neck too.
It's interesting in your book you detail, though, there were some terrible consequences of that event for the actual villages and things. These villages were razed to the ground by the Germans in punishment.
Not necessarily as a result of the Kuiper operation. There was a lot of other stuff going on at the same time. It's perhaps too long to go into it, but the Germans were about to make an ordered retreat to the western part of the island. So they were going to terrorise the areas that had been most troublesome so that they wouldn't have any trouble while they were making that retreat.
But that stitch that tied him to Greece would last his lifetime.
Absolutely. It did indeed. No, and he settled there and lived there very happily for over 40 years.
And in sort of classic style, and in boy's own style as well, he was a pretty red-blooded male. He had a long love affair with the last of a line of Byzantine princesses. He swam the Hellespont, tipping his hat to Byron. So he did all these kind of properly amazing things.
Oh, he did, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And what
got
did that...
Got into fights with Irish huntsmen.
Precisely. So it would be nice to know. Yeah, the Irish huntsman thing is quite an amazing thing. But tell us about this Byzantine princess that
she was the first great love of his life. And she was 16 years older than him. He very gallantly reduced the figure to 12 when he talked about her, but she was actually 16 years older. And I think she was very artistic, very imaginative. They'd met in Athens. Her marriage was over by then when they met. And I think she was very touched by his youth and brilliance. And I like to think she gave him sort of a bit of polish too. You know, I think he was probably a little bit too brilliant and a bit sort of show-offy and know-it-all. And she would sort of gently calm him down. And, you know, so I think she was a very, very good influence on him. And he went to live with her in her house in Moldavia, in eastern Romania, with her sister and her brother-in-law. And I think that was the equivalent of his university. He learnt Romanian. He read all the sort of French classics and Russian classics in French, that is. And I think he really got to understand what he was about a lot in those four precious years before the war started.
How did you meet him in the first place?
I suppose I'd known him because he'd known my grandmother, he'd known my father. So by the time I sort of really, well, the first time I got my schoolgirl crush on him, I was about 17, I think.
Because he was a very handsome man as well.
Yes, he was. Yeah. And he must have been, I suppose, late 40s, 50s by then. We were on Spetsy where my grandmother had taken a house, and Paddy came along for a few days. In the evenings, we'd go down to the tavernas and Paddy would start dancing with the men. These are amazing dances. I just thought I was in Zorba the Greek. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And I've never sort of, the stars haven't got out of my eyes yet.
Well, finally then, do they make them like that anymore?
Oh, sure they do. We just have to find them.
A good project for a next book, right? For the time being, Artemis Cooper, thank you very much for coming on.
It's a great pleasure.
Weekly. Thank you.
When Sydney opera singer Adrian Tamburini isn't wowing audiences in his city's iconic opera house, he's outside enjoying its gorgeous surf beaches and magnificent harbour.
We have some incredible nature. Sydney, for example, is built around the water. There is water everywhere. There is sunshine. An outdoor kind of lifestyle is really important to us here in Sydney. And that reflects in the way we approach life.
There's nothing like Australia.
This week, members of Syria's opposition groups have been in the Qatari capital, Doha, to try to establish a plan for unity in the troubled nation.
It's a fractured conflict with perhaps only one clear target, the removal of President Assad. But people are working on new ways to get complicated information into the news agenda. One of them is Syria Deeply, a new online, some might say social network, designed to challenge real-time events to journalists and educators in the West.
Joining us on the line now from Doha is news correspondent Lara Satrakian to tell us more about the options for Syria's future and also the website. Lara, thanks so much for joining us. Before we talk about Syria Deeply, just bring us up to speed a little bit and give us some of the atmosphere of what it's been like to be in Doha. It's quite hard to imagine all these opposition groups arriving in the city. It's a kingdom which has got very good at kind of hosting these kinds of events. But has there been a meeting of minds, do you feel?
There's certainly a sense that this is as far removed as you can be from the conflict on the ground. One doctor from Deir ez-Zor who's been treating the wounded in their survival conditions was just shocked to go from that to the five-star buffet at the Ritz Hotel in Doha. So there's a bit of surreal atmosphere around all this, this sense that the political haggling that's happening here to try to form one unified opposition body is really almost irrelevant to the people on the ground, except for the fact that this is exactly what it's going to take for the international community to feel comfortable enough with the revolution to start channeling greater levels of financial aid, more concentrated assistance and on the military front. This meeting of the minds in Doha is the necessary condition for greater backing behind the Syrian revolution, without which there's no way they can break this stalemate. It's been really interesting, guys, to see some of the luminaries, though, of the revolutionary camp, of the dissident pool in Syria, arrive here in Doha and really try to hammer out a negotiation between the various groups, primarily the Syrian National Council and now what's being called the Syrian National Initiative under Riyad Saif. It's basically a haggling for seats, for the personalities who are going to be out front. There's an expectation they'll eventually come to an agreement, and that will give us a kind of mechanism to watch a more unified opposition going forward.
And do you think any of these opposition leaders have their heads been turned by the opulence of Doha, Lara? Do you think there might be a few not getting back on the plane?
Definitely. Well, the Qataris have made it clear that they're not allowed to leave until they find a solution. And I don't think they mind terribly. So
right, yeah.
It's not exactly the kind of bargain they want to drive down in terms of leverage. But there is a sense on a more realistic front that even some of the names we've been hearing for the past year, Burhan Ghalioun, Abdulbaset Sida, these are the leaders of the Syrian National Council, and they have taken up a lot of space and a lot of airtime, but in the capitals, in the traveling Western capitals and conferring in Doha, you do lose touch somewhat, and that was the major complaint about them, and this is why the U.S. said it felt the need to basically steer the opposition in a whole new direction.
Now, as the events in Syria have unfolded over the year, I think that most Western leaders have begun to wonder whether they're kind of losing any chance of influencing events on the ground, because we're seeing more Islamist groups arising, we're seeing the sectarian thoughts becoming more powerful even amongst some of the kind of opposition groups. Is this really, this meeting in Doha, a kind of a final bid by Western governments to try and have some influence on the ground without supplying too directly arms?
It certainly feels that way, and it's a structural challenge for the West, because every time you back people outside of the country, it just takes months before they become practically irrelevant because the situation on the ground is moving so fast. But I mean, there's so much weight right now behind this new initiative, this new push. I've been talking to diplomats from France, Italy, the U.S. They've all clustered around this meeting, the Friends of Syria, the core group of them, really hoping it would work. So if it doesn't, I mean, in a sense, they are out of ideas.
And Lara, Syria Deep, this is the network that you've set up. And one of the aims, I think, is to channel information to journalists, to collate information or real-time sort of feeling on the ground that people are in Syria are finding and uploading. How easy has it been to sort of aggregate things? And how easy is access to the modes of social networking, to mobile phones and the like?
It's easier than we thought, in the sense that we as the journalists covering Syria have been watching all of that citizen-generated content, all of that video and imagery coming up from the ground. And we have enough of a scatterplot now to vet what we see and to know what's important and why. we know we've come to understand the track record of some of the folks we deal with on the ground as sources, as collaborators. So there's a sense that you can kind of get a better perspective on what we do see. But the real push behind Syria Deeply was to take a new approach entirely to digital storytelling, to create what's become a team of journalists and technologists to rethink our content architecture foremost. How do we bring the most important pieces into place? How do we explain, especially for an American audience, more of the context and history behind this? So essentially, we were devising what was a kind of news tutor around the Syria story. How do you get people caught up and add value to the other headlines they see?
And Laura, could I just quickly ask you, what was the kind of motivation, though, the deep motivation? Is it the belief that not enough good information is getting out, or the information is getting out isn't being contextualized correctly, or that, you know, the American news outlets on a whole aren't that keen on keeping on running stories from Syria?
It was the sense that the user experience of the Syria story sucked, that even if the information were there, it weren't being put together properly. It wasn't being contextualized, and especially for an American audience, we have to catch up. We haven't learned about the more complex and sophisticated dynamics in a country like Syria. So I feel beholden to an American audience to make that much easier to understand.
All right, Laura. Well, when the news sucks, make your own news. Laura Satrakian on the line from Doha. Thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. Time for a little music now. This is out last week. It is Tidal Wave by someone new and British and quite exciting, Soft Focus. You can't just give it away like it means nothing. I wanna know why. That was Soft Focus with Tidal Wave, and you are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be looking back to the US election after this. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Now, the election may be over, and thankfully there's no hanging chads, but the debate about how different kinds of Americans should get to the polls to cast their vote is one that will always be hotly contested.
US comic and journalist Mo Rocca has helped cover elections for news staples Larry King and Jon Stewart, and his new documentary, Electoral Dysfunction, questions the red tape and bureaucracy that some says help warp the electoral process. He joins us on the line now from New York. Mo, welcome to The Weekly.
Good to be with you.
So, first question should really be, was it a fair fight this year?
Was it a fair fight? You know, I haven't heard any big charges that people were kept from the polls. Of course, there were a lot of charges ahead of time about photo ID laws, which were a big hot-button issue in the American election this year. Mostly Republicans introducing legislation, and much of it passing, that said that in certain states you would have to show up with a government-issued photo ID. And most Americans, actually, when asked that question, agree that that's reasonable. But then when you inform Americans a little bit more that there are people, generally poorer people and older people and students, that don't always have government-issued photo ID, then their opinions change and they think, well, wait a minute, maybe that's not so reasonable. Maybe that's an effort to keep people from voting.
And voter fraud, it was talked about quite a bit before this election, and it's obviously the subject of your film, which was made 4 years ago during the Obama's first successful presidency or first election. Has it sort of changed much? Have guidelines been tightened up?
Well, those guidelines have been tightened up. The thing is that the term voter fraud naturally makes people very nervous, but it's a very vague, amorphous term, and it's become a political football. There are several different ways to vote in this country, and still the most popular way, though it's diminishing pretty rapidly, is to show up on the day of the election at the poll in person. Well, in over 12 years of voting in America, during which literally hundreds of millions of ballots have been cast, there have only been 10 convictions for in-person voter fraud, that is, voter impersonation, showing up and saying you're somebody that you're not, which sounds like a comedic sketch or something from the Carol Burnett show. And it just doesn't, and the reason it doesn't happen is because if you want to steal an election, doing that only nets you one vote, and you could go to prison for between 5 and 10 years and incur really a huge fine.
It doesn't sound like a criminal masterstroke, does it? Turning up and saying you're Mickey Mouse when you're not.
Exactly. It's like, it's definitely one of those classic dumb criminal, stupid criminal stories. But absentee ballots, where you vote by mail, is much more vulnerable to fraud. So all this legislation that was introduced to make it tougher for people to vote in person actually, ironically, drives more people into the absentee voter pool, which is prone to fraud.
And Mo, I wanted to ask you, over the last couple of weeks, we were covering a story which was about how it's so varied how people vote across the US. You have some people, you know, voting via electronic means, other people not. Is there this kind of inconsistency between the states? Does that also leave room for kind of manipulation and for the dysfunction that you highlight?
Totally. I mean, one of the things is, in this country, and I am proud of it too, that the idea of local, I don't know how in the UK if it's similar, but you know, local control is so prized here. And you know, people think of Mayberry or the Andy Griffith Show, you know, like, oh, it's great when a town council is running things and decides how its citizens will vote. But for a national election, when you're electing somebody as important as the President of the United States, it actually only makes for chaos and for hanging chads. I mean, do you have a situation in this country, because of the emphasis on local control, where, you know, county election supervisors are designing ballots, people who have no business designing a ballot, and design things like the butterfly ballot, which, of course, was with the hanging chads and through the election to George W. Bush in 2000. So every state has its own standards. And the reason is, not to get into a big history lesson, is because the framers of the Constitution weren't sure who should have the right to vote back in 1787. And so they punted, basically. They just sort of left it out of the Constitution, and it defaulted to the states.
And your film, Electoral Dysfunction, this looks at Indiana specifically, which 4 years ago was a swing state. There was a lot talked about Indiana this week as well, of course. You've obviously found some pretty amazing subjects, human subjects, for your film. Were you surprised at the level of, well, maybe we should put it nicely, sort of charming ignorance on behalf of some of your subjects.
Well, I mean, you know, it's I'm surprised that I'm continually surprised. Maybe it's that even trying to explain something like the Electoral College, and I was very heartened by this, but for my regular job on CBS News, I did a piece on how the Electoral College works, which is really important to understand, that we don't have a popular vote in this country, that, you know, it's winner take all from each state, blah, blah, blah. And I've had people come up to me since that piece aired and say, thank you so much. And people that don't seem like they were raised by wolves, who will come up to me and say, oh my goodness, thank you so much for that piece. I had no idea that's how it worked. And I thought, oh my God, like you completed 4 years of high school, you maybe went on to higher education, and you had no idea how our president was elected.
All right, Mo Rocker, thank you very much for your time on The Weekly. The film is called Electoral Dysfunction. It seems like iTunes is the best way to watch that. You are tuned in to The Monocle Weekly. I'm Robert Bound, and with Andrew Tuck. We'll be back in a sec.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour. Quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
Here in London, we're constantly reminded that history is all around us, so much so that sometimes it's nice to escape history and enjoy an afternoon in your local, chatting about your own week instead.
But the Humble Pub is the place that London's historic figures did their own catching up too, and that hasn't escaped our final guest, author Pete Brown.
His new book, Shakespeare's Local, tells a 6th-century story of just one South London establishment that's said to have gathered the likes of Chaucer, Dickens and, of course, Shakespeare for a quick half. He joins us in the studio now. Hi, Pete.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, I was flicking through the book this morning, and also by Pete Brown,
yes,
on the inside cover leaf. Man Walks Into a Pub is one of your books.
Yep.
Three Sheets to the Wind, another one of your books. Hops and Glory is another one of your books.
Yes.
All brilliant punning titles.
You can see a theme emerging.
I can see a theme emerging. What came first, the beer or the love of Shakespeare and history?
The love of Shakespeare and history came as a total surprise, actually.
Okay, good.
Yeah, the love of beer was always there. I always wanted to write. There's quite a lot of books about beer around the world. Beer everywhere is having a real renaissance at the moment. But a lot of the books on beer that I found as a drinker were books about hops and barley and how beer's made and big brewing vessels. And I was much more interested in the social and cultural role of beer and pubs and bars around the world. And that's been my writing up to the last, you know, for the last 10, 12 years, really, is why we drink, what effects it has, why, for the vast majority of people, it's a pleasant, life-enhancing experience at a time when we're being sort of scared with stories about binge drinking. And for most people, the pub is a wonderful place that's life-affirming, where we meet our friends, where we have the best times of our lives, really. And I wanted to reflect that and show that it's something that's been universal and eternal.
Yeah, yeah. Cheers to that.
When you tried to choose a subject for your next book, was the George Inn somewhere you already drank, or did you kind of potter around London by bus trying to find the place that had the kind of the best tale to tell?
Yeah, we got it down to a few. There was a shortlist. I already knew the George. There's a story towards the end of the book which I'll just sort of leave hanging. But a less than pleasant time that I had when I was filming a TV program in there once, and we found a bunch of people at the next table who'd been rather overindulging, and the TV program never got made because of the sound effects in the background from someone being ill. But yeah, the idea was to write, you find one historic pub and use it as a case study to show how amazing pubs are. And there are two or three, I mean, there's a whole list of pubs in London that have this incredible history, which is quite remarkable because the number of times London's been burnt down, demolished, bombed, everything else through the centuries. And there are about about three or four pubs that can claim a lineage right back to the Middle Ages. And the George is one of them. And when I just started looking into it, the stories around the George were just the stories that carried it, really. It's in a district of London called Southwark, which is just south of the river. And for most of London's history, this was the southern point of the only bridge across the Thames. So it's where all human life came to London. When London was the biggest city in the world, everyone trying to get in came to this choke point south of the bridge. And there were pubs there to greet them while they were waiting to get across.
Physically, is there any remnant of that medieval pub remaining?
No, I mean, everything's burnt to the ground many, many times. The current pub that's standing dates back to 1677. So not quite medieval.
I thought you were going to say to 1967. No, that's not bad.
1677 is still pretty impressive.
I went to the George the other day completely by chance. And it still feels very old. We were talking before we turned the mics on about that, the room with the open fire, which is very beautiful, seems very ancient. There's like a sort of minstrel's gallery, isn't there, as well? And it's in a cobble courtyard itself, so it feels, it's got a feel of history. Maybe it was just the dark and danky afternoon in which I went to it, but it has a feel of history about it.
Yeah, I mean, that building has stood there for well over 300 years, and when it was burnt down, it was built to the previous style. It was kind of just rebuilt, so it resembles a pub that stood there for a lot longer before that. And in its prime, that courtyard, it's a strange place. You've got a very busy high street, then this tiny little alleyway, and it opens out into this cobbled courtyard that you described, and there's the pub down one side of it. Now, in its prime, that whole courtyard was the pub. The galleries, the balconies went all around three sides of the courtyard. And then there was an alleyway at the back through to a second courtyard where all the coaching sheds and stables were. This was not just a pub. It was a huge business complex that had warehousing and stables. And it was like a hotel, coach station, a storage place and an office block and the biggest pub you've ever seen, all rolled into one.
I wish I had a time machine, didn't you?
I think they need to rebuild it.
Oh, yeah.
Now, tell me, give us an example of one or two of the characters, not the famous characters, that pop up in it, because this is a tale also of highwaymen, of these amazing people who ran these coaching companies. Give us an example of one or two of the people who kind of populate your pages.
There are some quite amazing and eccentric characters who crop up. One of my favourite guys, it was someone I've never heard of before. When you're researching history like this, you tend to come across people who left very detailed documents of their time and wrote a lot. And some of these people, like Chaucer and Dickens, are obviously very famous. And there's others who weren't quite as good as them. And they wrote just as much, but they were a bit rubbish. And finding those guys was really entertaining. There's a guy called John Taylor who called himself the Water Poet. And one thing he wrote was a timetable.
Which is a pub near Liverpool Street.
It is a pub, yeah. It's named after him. Yeah. And I'm curious to find out whether they know the full story of the guy that they named their pub after. He was a notorious self-publicist. He did things like he made a boat out of paper and rowed it from the middle of London to the Isle of Sheppey, about sort of 20, 30 miles away, using dried fish as oars, as a publicity stunt for the hemp industry. And then he wrote this timetable of all the wagons, all the goods wagons that left London. He basically invented the hobby of train spotting by just creating this diary of what coaches left from where. And this is where he mentions the George. And it's a traumatic thing to read because in those days before copyright, books were written by subscription. People would pledge an amount of money. And then when he went round to collect it, not all of them paid up. And so the first few pages of his carrier's cosmography, this timetable, is a rant against bad payers, saying that he wishes they'd all be hung because of the dreadful trials and tribulations he had when he was writing this book, all of which he was forced to wash away with several pints of beer at every pub he came to.
Poor boy.
The boat trip certainly sounds like a kind of a bet or a dare after a few pints,
exactly.
Doesn't it?
This kind of behaviour goes back a lot longer than we think.
And does the pub have a sense of its own history? We said in the introduction that Chaucer, Shakespeare, and Dickens have drank there. Did Shakespeare, for example, know that Chaucer had been there? Did Dickens know that Shakespeare had been there? Was it a place of famous sort of drinking pilgrimage at all?
It was just one of many. For at the time Chaucer and Shakespeare were around, it was one of about seven or eight of these massive establishments, all in a long line. By Dickens's time, it was much different. There was a sense of nostalgia creeping in by that point, and he writes about these great coaching inns in Pickwick Papers, his first novel, and describes this sort of forgotten time. And by about a century later, when Dickens is no longer around, we see the birth of this thing that we now call nostalgia, this desperate yearning for the past.
That was quite a Victorian thing, though, wasn't it?
It really
Dickens was.
Dickens
was a great sentimentalist as well.
Exactly. And what this comes to a crescendo in the 1920s after the First World War, because, you know, we've got progress and technology and the Industrial Revolution and the white heat of technology and everything. And this culminates in tanks and mustard gas and barbed wire and machine guns in the First World War. And so the 1920s, you just see this huge reaction against modernity, and people start to cling to the George as a bit like a life raft, this link back to Charles Dickens and this past age of London. And it's quite emotional reading some of the contemporary accounts from that time where people are just going, why can't we just have it back? Why can't it just be like in the old days?
I liked your Pickwick Papers quote, because you said you have to give the whole thing. Filled up 2 pages. That saved you some time, didn't it?
It certainly did.
I'm going to be doing that when I do my book.
Copyright, there we go. Bag. It is a problem when you're writing about something that the greatest novelist the world has ever seen has already written about. It's like, right, I'll paraphrase Dickens. I'll try and improve on what Dickens said. You can't. It's just perfect.
You don't want to be the water poet too.
No. Yeah. And there was at this time, the 20s and 30s, there was a real slew of books about old coaching inns written by people who thought they could write in a Dickensian argot.
Oh, that's awful.
And oh God, some of it stank the room out. It really did.
And that part of London is pretty rich in pubs, isn't it? There's a lot of there's in places like the Boot and Flogger, which is just around the corner. It's it's obviously a very historic part of London for the reasons you said. Yeah. That it was the only bridge across the river. Did your shortlist include any other places in that neck of the woods?
It didn't. No, I mean the George is the one that's got the best story, the best recorded history. When we had the idea to write the history of one pub, I thought, well, there's probably some pubs somewhere that have got way better stories, but until recently, things just didn't get written down. And so, you know, you get these kind of oral histories that get handed down from generation to generation. But the reason I could write about the George is because these famous people had been there and it had been recorded. And, you know, some of the smaller places that perhaps had more interesting and unsavoury characters, you just don't know what went on there. That's the thing. It's just speculation.
Yeah. And tell me about the product. I met a guy the other day who was telling me about kind of coffee in the period of the coffee houses in London, and I was asking what it tastes like, and his simple description was shit. He said it was so awful. Yeah. But people liked the kick you got from it. Everyone hated the taste. It wasn't smooth at all. Tell me about the beer. You're a beer man. Mm. You know, the beer, was it brewed on the site back in those days? Was it a disgusting kind of hoppy mess? What did they drink?
When you go back early enough. Most pubs brew their own beer, and the George certainly would have done, even though there's no evidence of it, but it would have done at some point. But the other thing about Southwark is it used to be home to a brewery called the Anchor Brewery, which was, in its time, the most famous brewery on the planet. And one thing we're appalling at in the UK is we've got an incredible rich history of brewing that people in other countries around the world really look to us and admire us for, and we just don't respect it ourselves. The Anchor Brewery is so famous, it was visited by heads of state from all around the world, Napoleon III and Garibaldi from Italy after the Russian Revolution and things. And one guy, an Austrian tyrant.
There's a few Australian ones as well these days.
Who brutally suppressed revolutions around Europe. And when he came to visit, he was tarred and flogged and beaten up the streets with brooms by the brewery workers. But that produced a beer called... there was a big industrial beer called Porter, which eventually led to Stout, which I think, you know, most people are familiar with Guinness, which is a world-famous stout, but a lot of stouts are more characterful and interesting than that. And then there was Russian Imperial Stout, which the Anchor Brewery perfected, which was a very strong export beer.
I had that in Russia last week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was weird. Amazing. I thought it was Guinness, but it wasn't. It was this stuff that was still really popular.
Catherine the Great used to get absolutely mad for it. And and so it was quite famous. They were drinking some pretty good beer,
actually.
That's
what made
her great. That could be the poster, couldn't it? Catherine the Great says, I'm mad for it.
Yes.
And also, it's the George is a Green King pub, I think, now.
It's managed by Green King,
and it's there's some beer on tap there that I've never had before, but it's some special sort of extra strong reserve IPA, which is one of the most delicious beers I've ever had.
Yes.
Is that because of the history of the pub? Because I've never seen it in any other IPA pub.
It's a new launch. Right. It's a new launch that came out in April, and very kindly they've done a short-run bottling of that for me, Shakespeare's Locale.
Oh, nice. Can we end on that pun? I think we have to.
We probably do.
Pete Brown, author of Shakespeare's Local, 6 centuries of history seen through one extraordinary pub. Thank you for taking time out of the pub to come and join us today. Pete Brown was great, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was amazing. And it was funny that you'd just been to the pub. Yeah. That pub.
Yes, exactly, not the pub.
Or actually, if you'd chosen any pub in London, would you have been able to say that in the sentence? Yeah, I've just been to that pub.
It was just called research.
Okay.
I don't know. That's just sometimes what you have to do.
No, how about?
I'm hoping if I describe his book as the best book ever written, he'll put my quote on it and entertain me royally when it comes in paperback.
But how great that you can almost, I know you didn't want that, but you can almost go and perch yourself on one seat and then kind of look around you, and that's more than enough to amazingly fill.
It's fascinating. He's sort of like the Jonathan Meads of pubs. You can just sort of walk down one street and be able to tell you all the sort of attitude and history that was part of it. It's pretty cool. And it's that sort of story. It's never a chore doing research for, is it?
No, and
I should imagine he's enjoyed doing some research on it as well.
Yeah, and actually, let's also talk about the Patrick Leigh Fermor book as well. That's also Artemis. Is another person who's had amazing subject matter, and we talk about these days about what the role of the book is and et cetera. But as soon as you see these two people come in with their kind of nice paper piles of paper, they're amazing things, and both of them I want to kind of steal and keep.
Yeah, exactly. We'll have to tussle over these two, haven't we? We'll draw straws for them, perhaps.
You're bigger than me. I think you probably get what you want.
But also, on Patrick Leigh Fermor, that's sort of last of a generation of. I mean, he seemed to be like last of a generation of kind of like those guys from the 30s that sort of like. Rocked and rolled across Europe and
incredible
sort of tell the tale.
He lived till he was 90 plus, and that's that means that you live through an extraordinary amount of pieces of history, and you join so many dots by accident, as Artemis was saying. You can't choose the time you live in, but he certainly made the most of it.
He not only swam across the Hellespont, but he walked from the Hook of Holland to Constantinople. You did some interrailing, didn't you?
I did some interrailing.
There's your book. Let's do it.
The interrailing years. Yeah. Before everyone else
Andrew
did
Tuck,
it.
The interrailing years. Let's do it.
How I slept on trains around Europe.
Yeah.
I do feel bad, though, if he walked all that way. Because just yesterday when I was thinking about going to get lunch from here, I was thinking, can I walk all the way around to Marylebone High Street? I can't be bothered. Too far to go.
If there was a Byzantine princess going to serve you in Paul,
I might nip round and say hello.
We're going to wrap it up now, Andrew. 175 editions of the Monocle Weekly. That was edition 175. I've been Robert Bound with Andrew Tuck. It was produced by Tom Hall. It was engineered by Jack Phillips. Andrew, he's kind of doing a Mobot through the glass there, because I almost called Mo. Rocker Mo Farah.
That would have been not good. Anyway, it's been a good show. Thank you, Robert.
Jolly good show. Well, for the time being, for me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Goodbye.